AT&T Fiber presents a straightforward moment.
Your wine?
Thanks. I'll pretend I know what I'm doing before saying it's good.
And I'll pretend I don't know you're pretending.
Are you a gagillionaire?
Yeah, I have AT&T Fiber. The straightforward pricing has inspired me to be more straightforward.
Me too.
Ugh, this wine. I'll fetch you a better one.
Straightforward is better. No equipment fees, no data caps, no price increase at 12 months. Live like a gagillionaire with AT&T Fiber. Limited availability in select areas. Visit att.com/hypergig for details.
This is a Piccolo podcast production.
Welcome to Adam Chat at Large. This is a tough one. Derek Ernest Percy was a sadistic and twisted serial killer. We'll never really know how many young kids he killed to satisfy his depraved fantasies. He was only convicted of one murder, the killing of 12-year-old Yvonne Toohey at Warneet near Melbourne in July 1969. It's possible that he killed other children, perhaps half a dozen. He took his disgusting secrets to the grave in July 2013. The one-time naval cadet would have gone on killing had he not been apprehended by police after a witness bravely gave evidence against Percy. That witness was 11-year-old Shane Spiller. He was with Yvonne Toohey on that day and was also an intended victim of Percy. The two kids were on their way to the beach when Percy grabbed Yvonne. Shane was carrying a small tomahawk and brandished it at the cowardly Percy, who backed off. The boy made the agonizing decision to run and get help, leaving Yvonne behind, the anguished cries of his friend ringing in his ears. His identification of Percy and his vehicle led police to the killer within hours of Yvonne's murder, and her mutilated corpse was discovered. Shane Spiller never got over this experience, and Derek Percy controlled his mind until Shane tragically disappeared in 2002. He was then living in Wyndham, a small town in southern New South Wales, and had become friendly with a local cop, Detective Sergeant Mark Winterflood. Mark did everything he could to find Shane. He searched in vain, and the case is one that's always stayed with him. You see the trauma that comes from these situations. It doesn't stop with the victim and their family. It's all those who are exposed to what happened. And I've spoken to Mark before about this. He's a bloke that cares about his job. He's now retired, but he's a bloke that cares about his job, and he really did his utmost. And you still carry these things with you. So I thought he'd be a great person to talk to about that sort of trauma that sort of it doesn't end. And he's my guest today. G'day, Mark.
G'day, Adam. Good to be with you.
As always. Tell us about your career. How did you end up in the Bega Wyndham area?
So I applied for a promotion to Bega back in 94, went there in 95 with my family, thinking it would be a five-year project and we'd pursue promotion elsewhere. So the kids went to school and grew up there, and I retired down there and kept living in the town for many years afterwards, yeah.
And you covered some pretty amazing cases, some horrendous ones. I mean, the Bega schoolgirls murder, for a start, which was one that you worked long and hard on. And we've discussed that in another podcast. So I won't go there in this one because it was bad enough as it is. But the Shane Spiller case, and I understand why it stayed with you, because this bloke was just one of life's victims. And you came to know him. Do you remember how that relationship began?
Yes, he'd actually met another colleague that was working at Bega at the time, and he said, "This is a guy you should meet and get to know." And so when I met him, he told me about the Percy thing, and my immediate sort of feeling was people do big note themselves a bit when they introduce themselves. Anyway, I just took it with a grain of salt, but he clearly knew a lot about growth of cannabis around the Wyndham area. So I thought he'd be quite useful to us. And in those days, you had registered informants, but they were only registered on paper in your office. There was no computerization of it. So in time, I made him a registered informant, and we had contact on and off. He would ring me a lot over a period, and then you wouldn't hear from him for quite a while, and then he'd be back in and something else was going on. But every conversation would have some reference to the Percy matter.
Fascinating. So depending on what state you're in, you could call him your fizz or your gig or your informer. What's the terminology in New South Wales for that?
The informal terminology is gig, but formerly he'd be an informant.
So, I mean, the thing about him was that he had to, not once but twice, identify Percy, had to go up physically and in front of Percy, having already been through the experience of seeing Yvonne Taken, looking into this man's eyes, running away, hearing the anguish cries. He then has to go do a lineup, identify him, and then when he's giving evidence in the court, I can only imagine the trauma. You see how different things were done back in 1969. There was no conception of the impact on someone of this sort of a process, but you saw that when you met him. Did he talk about the whole experience?
Yes. And I guess the first thing I have to admit is, in those days, we didn't have access to interstate information. So for my system, I could only find out limited things about the Percy matter. I think it wasn't until about 6 months later, when he was talking about it, he actually had this big folder, which he showed quite a few people. Anyway, he left that with me. And I got more from reading that and the newspaper articles from back in the late 60s, early 70s, than I did from any of the cop systems. So that's where I became more acutely aware of the depth of his sort of agony with all of that. Like you said, times have changed.
I think definitely dealing with the trauma is a now thing. And despite the fact that Percy was never going to get out of jail, there was going to be no non-parole period for him. He was there for the term of his natural life.
Yeah.
Shane believed that Percy could still get him, that somehow he was the reason that he'd stopped this spree, and with good reason. I mean, Percy had a very, very detailed fantasy life and a real desire to hurt people. In fact, the down here in Victoria, there are all his writings and fantasies that were found in a locker. And
that's right.
The depth and depravity of those is such that you couldn't even print them. So for Shane to believe that there was still this pent-up desire to hurt and affect people was pretty reasonable, although there was no way he was getting out.
Yes, and my recollection is there was a time when there was a publicly known review of Percy's situation, and that was a high-stress time for him. He spoke to me. And that was when I read most of that material, and I spoke to his barrister about it. So I had some idea that, you know, the trauma that he was going through. And when you meet the guy, he was a clearly very anxious man. He was very lean, very nervous, may have had some other sort of disability as well, I'm not sure. But, there was a host of problems in the background that you didn't have to be a psychologist to see.
And he had, I think the biggest thing about him was his Ned Kelly bushy beard.
There was a period he had a very big beard.
They used to call him Stick because he was such a little slight figure.
Yes.
And he was known around the town. I mean, he, from what I understand, he self-medicated.
There was a group of four or five people that had a similar persuasion, and he was in that group. And it was a time when you could doctor shop and chemists were not connected electronically or computer-wise, so you can go from place to place with different scripts and multiply your opiate prescription. And so they would share and use them and become addicted to them. And that, in my view, may have well contributed to his final days.
Yes. So 2002, he suddenly disappears. And there are some strange circumstances. His motorbike is locked in the garage. His boots are in the house. There's a table for dinner set for two. Other other things that would lead you to have some suspicions about what might have happened. What were the early stages for you in that investigation?
Trying to think who brought it. I think Brian Hunter from the shop made it known to us. But as we discussed before, Wyndham being such a small place, once he disappeared, people were coming in with all sorts of theories very quickly, which we had to sort of deal with. And one of the disturbing things initially was that within a week or 10 days, friends who were involved in this opiate use had come to his house and were wheeling the fridge down the road to their place, and they had to be stopped to put it back. And then only a short time after that, the fellow involved overdosed on the floor of his home and he died. And there was a woman living there who I believe knew more. And after Shane died, she moved into his house. And so I tried to arrest her and deal with her for trespassing. And on legal advice, we couldn't proceed because I couldn't prove that Shane Spiller didn't consent. So she stayed there while the bank used up the rest of his compensation money from the government. And when that was done, the bank foreclosed on the loan and took the house back and kicked this woman out. So to me, she was probably the only person that would have known something about his death, and she refused to talk to us time and again. So, but apart from that theory, there's a possibility that he committed suicide or some other, you know, some other crime had sort of happened to him. But there was, we really couldn't advance that particularly.
No, but let's work back a bit. The days after he disappears, his mate's wheeling his fridge out the door. There's people moving into his house. These people, you would think, have a clear idea that Shane's not coming back.
Yes, they know something that we don't know. Yeah. So there were theories bouncing around the community about the hitman thing. And there's a messy background to that because 2 years prior, Shane had been friends with two fellows, one who just got out of jail, who were involved in a murder only a few kilometres away. And the guy involved in the murder had rolled Shane's car and damaged it. So, like we said before, he didn't pick his friends carefully. Anyway, after that murder, the co-accused, or the guy that was charged with being an accessory after the fact, took off to Queensland to stay out of the heat. And while he was gone, people robbed his shed of all his belongings. Well, then he and a colleague, because they knew of Shane's vulnerability, then rang and threatened him that they would come and blow his kneecaps off if he didn't help recover the property. So Shane rang his barrister, who told me, and then I went out to Shane's place, and we actually heard this bloke on the answering machine saying that. Those two people were charged with that intimidation, but that story was around Wyndham prior to his disappearance. So that obviously fed more ideas that Percy had, you know, been involved. And after he disappeared, we had the armed offender squad in Melbourne do a thorough search of his cell or for any information that would sort of corroborate. There was talk that Percy had a very large amount of money from his Navy pension. Well, we couldn't ascertain that. All we could ascertain was he had a small amount of money, a few thousand in an account, which he couldn't access. I think his mother and his lawyer were his only visitors over a long period of time, and they could find no reference to Shane Spiller. I've no doubt he would never have forgotten Shane, but he wouldn't know what he looked like or have much knowledge of his later life. Like you said, someone who fantasizes like that would never forget that fantasy.
Yeah, but thank you for following it up, because as remote a possibility as it sounds, for someone like Shane, this is a real possibility. This person inhabited his nightmares, was ever present in his thoughts, had literally shaped his life. So it's no wonder that he thought that was a possibility. And You know, the we do know that in the last few months before he disappeared, there had been a couple of suicide attempts.
Yeah. So I think probably about a month before he disappeared, he went into a mental health hospital in Goulburn. Now, to go there, it's a dedicated mental health place. You have to be scheduled to go there. So you've had a serious suicide attempt. So he was released from there after about a week, made a further attempt, which was pretty mild, by overdose, and went into Bega Hospital. I think he was self-admitted there and only stayed for 3 or 4 days and booked himself out, which he was quite entitled to. So he then returned back to his home at Wyndham and was seen once or twice after that. But the people that saw him noted that he really wasn't himself and wasn't well. It was quite apparent. And my knowledge of Shane was that the village or the town was his family. So as soon as that relationship stopped, you knew something serious had happened. He wasn't just taking off to avoid something. He was gone. And that was evidenced by no access to money, phone, anything. That was the day before mobiles or computers. He simply had a landline at home, and we checked every phone call in his last months of his life, and there was nothing, you know. So, a real mystery. But like you said, we then did lots of people nominated places where they thought he would have gone. The main one was a lookout where a friend of his who was tragically killed in a car accident, Shane took his ashes to throw off this lookout. So we thought he would have gone there, but that was closely searched. And then there was talk that his opiate-using friends had panicked and thrown him down a mine shaft. Or we went to several of those, and one of them was actually really deep, so we had to have specialists come with pump and empty the thing, and there was nothing down there. So whether he was buried or whether he was simply left in the bush, the reality is that, you know, wombats, eagles and foxes will dismantle a body very quickly over months, and there would be very little to find now at this point in time.
Well, that's right. People always jump to a conclusion when a body can't be found. There's always the line, well, bodies don't bury themselves. But listen, in that environment, it's unforgiving. And you're right, predation occurs. And, you know, but someone knew something about this. He was estranged from his family. It took you some time to even find his parents, who I think were living on a boat or something up in Queensland.
Yeah, that was I found that odd. And all I knew about his involvement with his family was that they parted ways in his late teens, and he became a bit of a walkabout and lost soul, and he really didn't reconnect with his parents since. And between 2002 and I think the inquest was in 2007, I had trouble tracking them down. Eventually, we had a break in Brisbane, and I think they were on a boat in Brisbane. And finally, I had a conversation with them on the phone to explain that the inquest was coming up. Would they come? Would they come and retrieve the last of his possessions? And they didn't. They didn't come to either. They were very polite, but they really didn't want to be involved. So clearly something went wrong back in that relationship quite early. Hard to know. I just found it a bit strange that parents would not sort of, be more at least interested after he disappeared.
Yeah, we can't know what's gone on inside the family home, but I'm sure that Shane would have had all manner of particular needs, emotionally, psychologically, and it's not always possible that parents can meet those. But, I mean, it must be a little bit daunting, though. You come from a beautiful family. I've met your wife and some of your children. Lovely people. But not everyone has the benefit of that. And Shane was just one of those people that missed out on everything. I mean, to have had that happen to him at such a young age, but to show such courage and character to stop a serial killer, you just would have hoped that it would have been a better outcome.
Yes, yeah. Well, like we said, he didn't choose his friends wisely, but anyone that befriended him would be his friend. And, you know, thinking back those days, people gave you information or the cops information for mainly two reasons, either for money or to knock out the competition in what they were involved in. The better the information, the better the friendship. You know, he wasn't out for reward or anything. And it would be the same with the opiate group or his drinking group. It was purely for friendship. And, yeah.
And this is a, when we say a small town, this is a small, tiny town, isn't it?
Yeah, shop, service station and a pub, and that was it. And his daily routine would be, you know, down to the pub for an early one and then go and get his mail and chat to people on the way and then go and tinker with motorbikes or cars. That was his life.
And it sounds like you did a very thorough investigation. It was a very thorough investigation. And you would have spoken to so many people, and I'm sure in the back of your mind you're thinking, come on, give Shane a break here. Come on. One of you knows what's happened here. If you've had a opiate misadventure with him, you're not going to be charged.
We just want to know where he is. But, you know, and I'm surprised that the woman that I think probably knows never talked to someone else in the community, because it's a place where you can't really keep secrets. Because everyone knows everyone else's business. And so it was disturbing that we could never really get a clear picture of what happened.
I hope, maybe I'm an optimist here, I always am, but I hope that someone hears this and speaks to somebody else who says Shane is X. How would that make you feel 20-odd years later?
I guess it'd be relief, but it would also be sad. I mean, it's the reality of being a person that has empathy for others, you feel that loss, and the fact that his last days were particularly miserable when he needed those friendships to support him and keep him going. In a sense, we failed him in that. He reached out to mental health people, but that was it. Yeah,
and I guess that's the thing with missing persons, is that the loved ones and friends always have this somewhat irrational hope that the missing person might just walk down the driveway against all the evidence, and the discovery of a body does remove that final piece of hope.
Yeah, it does. But what was weird with Shane was that if he was the sort of person that was going to take off and try and disappear, none of his transport options were there. And he wasn't a well man, so he couldn't have got far on foot. So that's why I think he's died locally and something's happened. We just can't pinpoint it.
What intrigues me, it's almost like something out of a murder mystery, is the table set for two. Do you have any idea who his last visitor was going to be?
No. We rang the person that he last spoke to on the phone, and there were no plans in that regard to call around. It was just a welfare call. But aside from the setting, there were also lots of dirty dishes and stuff in the sink. So whether that had been there for a few days, I don't know. We went right through the house, and things that were his livelihood, his chainsaw, his tools, everything was still there. So you knew that he wouldn't leave those things.
Yes, it is a mystery, and I think you're right. It probably is that he's had an overdose or some other misadventure, and someone has rather callously decided to dispose of his body rather than telling somebody, and that sometimes is the infantile behaviour you have to deal with human beings. But for you, that stays with you. And this was in the last few years of your long service on behalf of the people of New South Wales. You know, how did you finish up?
Very fatigued. I felt very burnt out, and eventually went to see medical people and got diagnosed with various things. And I still deal with the fatigue. I haven't sort of fully got my energy back. So, it's just, I guess when you understand the dynamics of what's happened, it's not so bad, it's not so surprising. But you know, and I think back to the times back in 2000, in the late 90s, when Shane was talking about it. At that time, PTSD and the police wasn't really talked about so much. It was more something that war veterans or Vietnam veterans suffered from, not that someone had from one particular bad experience. So it wasn't until Shane showed me that folder, which had a letter from a very well-respected psychiatrist at St. Vincent's as to his diagnosis and the drugs that he needed, that I sort of sat up and took notice. And then over the years that followed, quite a few colleagues of mine sort of fell off the perch and had to leave in a hurry. And it was then that we started to realise that this was a more serious thing than probably any of us understood when we were younger, you know. And I'm sure the, you know, police management now have a much better grasp of it, but certainly back then it wasn't an openly discussed subject or managed particularly carefully.
You know, you've got a beautiful family and they're very supportive, and you've had a busy life. You've remained connected to your community, and you know, but you see others who might not have that, and after their long service to the state and the public, they're left almost alone, and that's very hard for me to take.
As you said, being alone is the worst part of it. I've actually been amused because for entertainment, I'm watching a few of those shows called Alone. And the thing which knocks most of them out is they can't stand being alone more than 2 or 3 weeks, you know, in the bush. So through COVID, look how much we've noticed people being isolated and disconnected is really bad for human mental health.
It is. And, you know, I don't think this PTSD gets better as time goes by. I'll give you an example. I've been speaking to the sister of Yvonne Toohey for a long time, and our conversations probably 15 years ago were warm and connected and so forth, and she discussed aspects of what it's been like for her. But over that journey, things have changed. And I actually gave her a call on Mother's Day just a few days ago, and I could see how my call was now bringing it back to her again. So I resolved this is not a good thing. I won't do it again. And as much as that pains me not to do it, because the empath in me wants to do that and try to reach out, we may not be helping. And you know, people just find a way to accommodate these things in their lives by not dealing with it sometimes.
Yeah, I haven't actively sort of sought out. I don't know if it's like people, veterans from the war, but when I meet with colleagues, we don't talk about those things. We talk about the things that made us good mates and we enjoyed doing together. It's just how we cope.
Yeah. And for you living in Bega, you're about to leave Bega after a long time living in the town, and you were intimately involved in the Bega schoolgirl's murder, which was a horrendous, savage, brutal, unnecessary series of crimes. And you would see the families of those girls around the town. How was that?
Good in the sense that they really enjoyed my company and were always, you know, enthusiastic and very kind and affectionate. And we sort of, it's hard to say. I could see they were doing it tough, and them seeing me triggers, like you said, those past memories. So seeing me about the street is probably not that good for them sometimes, but they would never have said that to me, but I fear that I brought back some bad demons.
Well, yeah, I mean, trauma can be vicarious. I remember talking to you about this when we did our last podcast on the Bega schoolgirls murders, and going away, and I was shell-shocked, you know, and the way you describe finding those girls' bodies where they were, and I won't go into that for this podcast, but it stayed with me, and I thought about how it must be for you, and it just underlines, you know, the frailty of human beings, and how trauma is so long-standing, and you know, how would you avoid it in a job like yours? Really, I mean, you must have seen so much death and misery, and you know, how do you cope with it?
Yeah, well, so probably going to sound a bit weird, but my childhood was in a very non-emotional family, so I learned very comfortably not to express emotions, which is probably unhealthy, but it actually equipped me very well to deal with these scenes and these people, because I could quite comfortably walk around and just focus on the evidence and just not let the emotion of the moment trouble me at all. But of course, now in hindsight, you realise that cumulative is doing you some damage. And there are better ways to deal with it than not talking about it, you know.
I got another friend in Homicide New South Wales who talks about this, and he doesn't understand his own mind on this. I mean, he gives a good example where he was at a scene where someone had their brains blown out with a shotgun, and this room was just a horrendous scene with the walls painted with this guy's brains and blood. And it was the day that Steve Irwin had died. And he gets a text that Steve Irwin's died. At the same time, a piece of brain matter fell from the roof onto his head, and he wiped it away and said, "Oh, Steve Irwin's died." And the complete detachment, he said, "I must be crazy." But he's not crazy. He's just got a defense mechanism to keep doing this. You've got to front up each day and keep doing it.
And the weird thing is that no one ever trains you for that. You either survive it or you don't, and you learn you can cope with it. The police is that sort of career where it's very hard to prepare people. You can't say someone is, ideally suited to it, because it's a job you learn and mature in, and it takes a lot of years to get really sharp at it. And by then, you're quite often a bit damaged, you know.
But really, show me an engaged, adventurous life, and I'll show you damage of some kind or other, you know. So
yes,
it's. But I do think I guess you've got to look at the overall ledger and say, did I do good? Was I principled? Did I try my best in any given situation? And then I guess have to put up with at some level with what happened to you.
Yeah, I'm certainly feel that the overall effect of what I did was far outweighs the trauma that it caused me. You know,
and in the case of Shane Spiller, you did your very best for him, and it wasn't enough. And you wonder what actually happened to him. And I'm sure there's somebody out there who does know. But Mark Winterflood, thank you so much for sharing this story with us and your efforts on behalf of Shane and your service to the community of New South Wales.
Thanks, Adam. Much appreciated.
Yeah, that's retired Detective Sergeant Mark Winterflood, a truly terrific bloke, as you've just heard. And I'm sure there's somebody out there. I say this every time, but I'm going to be right one day. There's somebody out there listening right now who does know what happened to Shane Spiller. Do the right thing. Seriously, do the right thing. Do the right thing by Shane, by Mark, by all the people that have been affected by Derek Ernest Percy. I mean, Percy was a lost cause. He, you know, a disgusting individual. But, you know, there is some good in the world that can still come by resolving some of the trauma that goes with that. So get in touch. Crime Stoppers, 1-800-333-000. That's Crime Stoppers, 1-800-333-000. This has been Adam Shand at Large. And just a reminder, we are looking for a sponsor for Adam Shand at Large. If you want us to keep on doing this kind of work, it's up to you to get involved now. Give us a call, sponsor this program, and we can keep telling these stories that other people just simply aren't not telling. Thanks for listening.